Blog Talk Radio.
RBGs. Know what I mean? It's war. Know what I mean? Yo, stick. I mean, shit be real on war. The block. Pigs be out there, occupied army. RBGs. Takeover, not a makeover. Yeah. The cops stop you just because you black, that's war. Run you through the system for your prince, that's war. When they call my hood a drug zone, that's war. Slum lord charging you for rent, that's war. Why they so rich and we poor, that's war. If you young and black, you sell crack, that's war. The White House is the rock house, that's war. George Bush coming out his mouth, that's war. Chilling on the corner with your gang, that's war. Popo do the same damn thing, that's war. When they murdered I'ma do the yellow, that's war. Marching in the streets is a strategy of war. Knowing self-defense is a strategy of war. Soldiers try to link with other soldiers in the war. Revolutionaries got to know the art of war. War, what about hip-hop? Use that. Matter of fact, fuck a rap battle. What about a gap battle? Let's take it to the beast and see which cat tattle. Is it kids versus beans or B versus hoes? What about y'all real niggas against the 5-0? This is M1, DP, don't you forget. Cause you can talk, 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 but that don't mean shit. I ain't gotta pop the top to see where your brains went. This rap shit is way bigger than entertainment. It's the people versus the pigs when it all go down. It's not pop versus big, it's who's getting the power. And power ain't money, dog, it's self-determination. Like taking hot and making it the real people station, that's war. Know what I mean? Yeah. Rap war, whatever war. You live a fast life, more or less, more so, it's still war. Dead prayers, the people radio. Yeah. Get down, get down, get down. RBGZ, biatch.
You are now listening to WRBG, the people's radio. It's a takeover, not a makeover.
The merciful, to whom all praise is due, whom we forever thank for giving us the Honorable Elijah Muhammad as our leader, teacher, and guide. And I specifically, ladies and gentlemen, and brothers and sisters, open up like that because I am a representative of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. And were it not for him, you and I wouldn't be here today. in order for you and me to devise some kind of method or strategy to offset some of the events or a repetition of the events that have taken place here in Los Angeles recently, we have to go to the root. We have to go to the cause. Dealing with the condition itself is not enough. We have to get to the cause of it all, or the root of it all. And it is because of our effort toward getting straight to the root that people oftentimes think we are dealing in hate. But first, I would like to congratulate and give praise to the Negro, so-called Negro leaders and so-called Negro organizations. And excuse me if I say so-called, it's hard for me to just outright say Negro when I know what that word Negro really means. The person whom you have come to know as Ronald Stokes, we know him as Brother Ronald, one of the most religious persons who displayed the highest form of morals of any black person anywhere on this earth. And as one of the previous speakers pointed out who knew him, everyone who knew him had to give him credit for being a good man, a clean man, an intelligent man, an innocent man when he was murdered. The Negro, so-called Negro organizations and leaders should be given great credit for their failure or refusal to let the white man divide them and use them one against the other during this crisis. As Reverend Welford Wilson pointed out, I think it was 8 years ago today that the Supreme Court handed down the desegregation decision. And despite the fact that 8 years have gone past, that decision hasn't been implemented yet. I don't have that much faith. I don't have that much confidence, I don't have that much patience, and I don't have that much ignorance If the Supreme Court, which is the highest law-making body in the country, can pass a decision, can't get even 8% compliance with in 8 years because it's for black people, then my patience has run out. When black people who are being oppressed become impatient, they say that's emotional. Please, when black people who are being deprived of their citizenship, not only of their civil rights, but their human rights, become impatient, become fed up, don't want to wait any longer, then they say that's emotional. The Negro, so-called Negro leaders and organizations should be praised. They should be congratulated. They should be complimented, because out of all of them combined, the white man has not yet found one who will play the role of Uncle Tom. But yet he has found no Tom, no puppet, no parrot, who is still dumb enough in 1962 to represent the injustices that he's inflicting against our people. We don't care what your religion is. We don't care what organization you belong to. We don't care how far in school you went or didn't go. We don't care what kind of job you have. We have to give you credit for shocking the white man by not letting him divide you and use you one against the other. In the past, the greatest weapon the white man has had has been his ability to divide and conquer. As Jackie Robinson pointed out beautifully on the television last night, 4/5 of the world isn't white. Isn't that what Jackie said? And if 4/5 of the world is dark, how is it possible for 1/5 to rule, oppress, exploit, dominate, and brutalize the 4/5 who are in the majority? How do they do it? Divide and conquer. If I take my hand and slap you, you don't even feel it. It might sting you because these digits are separated. But all I have to do to put you back in your place is bring those digits together. This is what the white man has done to you and me. He has divided us and used us one against the other. But today, thanks to Allah, you can say thanks to God or thanks to Jesus or thanks to Jehovah, whatever you want. But as a follower of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, we have been taught to say thanks to Allah. And that's what Jesus said. Jesus called on Allah. He said, Allah, Allah, lama sabachthani. I believe what's good for Jesus is good for you. If Allah was good enough for Jesus to call upon, I think he should be good enough for you to call upon. Since the so-called Negro community has shot the white man by resisting all efforts to divide us, I think that you and I should continue to shock him by staying and working together in unity. Despite religious, political, economic, or educational, or social differences, let us remember that we are not brutalized because we're Baptist. We're not brutalized because we're Methodist. We're not brutalized because we're Muslim. We're not brutalized because we're Catholic. We're brutalized because we are black people in America. Hey, your mother is being raped and you're not supposed to be emotional. Your women, please, your women can't walk the street without some cracker putting his hands on her, and you're not supposed to be emotional. If you say that you're fed up, if you teach the Negro, they don't even know their own name. Why? Because he took it away from them. Please, please. 20 million black people don't even know their own language. Why? Because he took it away from them. 20 million black people who don't even know the history of their ancestors. Why? Because he took it away from them. And if you try and tell them how thoroughly and completely they've been robbed, he says you're teaching hate. That's something to think about. Today, you are coming out of college. You're coming out of the leading universities. You're trying to go in a good direction, but you don't know which direction to go in. And if somebody tries to take you right to the root of your problem, they say that that man's a hate teacher. If I ask why should the senators in Washington, and then again, if we tell you that Negroes are being hung on the tree or being shot down illegally, unjustly, and those Negroes should do something to protect themselves, you say you're advocating violence. The white man is tricking you. He's trapping you. He doesn't call it violence when he lands troops in South Vietnam. And please, please, please. He doesn't call it violence when he lands troops in Berlin. When the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor, he didn't say get nonviolent.
He said, praise the Lord, but pass the ammunition. But when someone attacks you, when someone comes at you with a club, when someone comes at you with a rope, when someone comes at you with a gun, despite the fact that you've done nothing, he tells you, suffer peacefully. Pray for those who use you despitefully. Be long-suffering. And how long can you suffer after suffering for 400 years? So I just want to clear up that little point right there, because he says that we play on your emotions. And when you turn on your television tonight, or your radio, or read the newspaper, they're going to tell you in that paper that I was playing on your emotions. Imagine you, a second-class citizen. That's not getting emotional, it's getting intelligent. And as far as your mayor is concerned, I see you should say their mayor, a man named Yorty, who has been slandering the Muslims, a professional liar. Who has mastered the art of using half-truths. Put it in the paper that they broke into our religious place of worship and got records that they can use to prove that most of us have criminal records. You can't be a Negro in America and not have a criminal record. Martin Luther King has been to jail. Please. James Farmer has been to jail. Why, you can't name a black man in this country who is sick and tired of the hell that he's catching who hasn't been to jail. Charge him with being seditious. They put Moses in jail. They put Daniel in jail. Why, you haven't got a man of God in the Bible that wasn't put to jail when they started speaking out against exploitation and oppression. They charged Jesus with sedition. Didn't they do that? They said he was against Caesar. They said he was discriminating. Because he told his disciples, go not the way of the Gentiles, but rather go to the lost sheep. He discriminated. Don't go near the Gentiles. Go to the lost sheep. Go to the oppressed. Go to the downtrodden. Go to the exploited. Go to the people who don't know who they are, who are lost from the knowledge of themselves, and who are strangers in a land that is not theirs. Go to those people. Go to the slaves. Go to the second-class citizens. Go to the ones who are suffering the brunt of Caesar's brutality. And if Jesus were here in America today, he wouldn't be going to the white man. The white man is the oppressor. He would be going to the oppressed. He would be going to the humble. He would be going to the lowly. He would be going to the rejected and the despised. He would be going to the so-called American Negro. To have once been a criminal is no disgrace. To remain a criminal is the disgrace. I formerly was a criminal. I formerly was in prison. I'm not ashamed of that. You never can use that over my head. And that he's using the wrong stick. I don't feel that stick. I went to prison because I believed in men like Sam Yorty. I went to prison because I trusted men like Sam Yorty. I went to prison following the philosophy of men like Sam Yorty. But since I've been following the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, I have been reformed, and that's more, please. That's more than Sam Yorty and Chief Parker and all these other white politicians have been able to do with the inmates in the prisons of this state. They should give Mr. Muhammad credit. They should give Mr. Muhammad credit for reforming and rehabilitating men whom they have failed to reform and rehabilitate. Referred to some press report that Mr. Muhammad had once been found guilty of contributing to the delinquency of a minor. He failed to explain purposely that in 1934, the Honorable Elijah Muhammad refused to send his children to the white schools in Detroit, Michigan that were teaching you about little black Sambo. That's the minor that he contributed to the delinquency of. You see, this vicious, fork-tongued white man has been able to take lies and make you turn against those who want to help you and make others turn against you. This is the contributing to the delinquency of a minor that this mayor, or man who calls himself mayor, is talking about. In the same article, he said that the Muslims are the same people who rioted in the United Nations. Someone should pull his coat and let him know that at the present moment, there are $6 million worth of suits leveled against two of New York's leading newspapers for making the mistake of charging the Muslims as being involved in those United Nations riots. We were not involved. And if this fork-tongued man who calls himself your mayor had taken the time to find that out, he wouldn't be walking into the trap that he's letting his ignorance lead him into. And if he would take the time to read the Washington Post that came out the Sunday after that incident took place, the Washington Post pointed out on the front page that the Muslims had nothing to do with the UN riots. And they quoted, in saying so, the person who was at that time the commissioner of police in New York City. See, it's lies that the white man has spread about the Muslims to try and make you afraid of the Muslims, or to try and make you think that the Muslims were a criminal element, an uncouth element, and things that you would not like to be associated with. Also, they say that I'm just clearing these things up, and then we're going to get into what happened. They also say that the Honorable Elijah Muhammad was a draft dodger. No, he wasn't. He just refused to go to the army because he was a man of peace. He was a minister of a religion of peace. He was teaching peace. So he outright refused to go to the army. That's not draft dodging. That's intelligence. Here before the grand jury. Because the coroner's jury is stacked against Negroes. The grand jury is stacked against Negroes. The press, the radio, the television, and the newspapers are stacked against Negroes. But the Los Angeles Police Department is stacked against Negroes. He is stacked against all Negroes. All except those whom he has appointed to high positions. The controlled press, the white press, inflames the white public against Negroes. The police are able to use it to paint the Negro community as a criminal element. The police are able to use the press to make the white public think that 90% or 99% of the Negroes in the Negro community are criminals. And once the white public is convinced that most of the Negro community is a criminal element, then this automatically paves the way for the police to move into the Negro community, exercising Gestapo tactics, stopping any black man who is on the sidewalk, whether he is guilty or whether he is innocent, whether he is well dressed.
Black power, black power, black nation. You're tuned into In Defense of the People weekly Tuesday night broadcast with your host, People's Political Party, National Chairman Nat Turner, co-host myself, National Minister of Defense, Brother Motherland, and our engineers on the ones and twos, Sister Amina, the National Minister of Communication, calling each and every Tuesday night, same black place, same black time at 845-277-9266, and press 1 to participate. Tonight's topic, Malcolm X, the greatest mind descendant America's ever produced. We're going to open up our phone lines to our national chair, Nat Turner. Yuhuru, black power and all power to the people. Comrade, can you hear me?
Yes, sir. Right on, brother. Yes, sir. Yeah, Yuhuru, man, all power. I'm saying black people, specifically black power. I want to welcome those who are listening to another show, In Defense of the People Radio. It is what it is, and we see it as an opportunity, whichever way, shape, or form. As far as like everything, like communication, with the person, or people, or group, or whatever, or a nation, or countries, or considered as a form of media communication. No, we don't own CNN, Fox, MSNBC, or the major networks, ABC, NBC, CBS, when there's a will, there's a way. We refuse to succumb to, the mainstream narrative, basically on anything from A to Z. We're in the struggle for our lives in this country as black people or people of African descent or whatever the name or classification you or we may use. It's all the same. They don't show no preference for the terminology when it comes to the brutal treatment. We went from Africans to niggas to Negroes to black Americans, now to Afro-Americans, African-Americans. Our leader back in this late 50s or 60s show tonight is dedicated to him. Malcolm X. There was a Chicago Red and a Detroit Red back in the day. Malcolm was Detroit Red, and Chicago Red was the comedian who became famous as Red Fox, the Sanford and Son half an hour sitcom. That hit in the it was the 70s and the 80s. And he had said that the funniest man he'd ever met in his entire life was Red Fox. Came a transformed man, his evolution, the highest type of man, as a revolutionary. Born 1925, Omaha, Nebraska. Malcolm Little. His parents, his father, was a Garveyite. For those who don't know what a Garveyite is, a Garveyite is a follower, a political descendant, or ideological descendant or disciple of a man known as Marcus Messiah Garvey. He was born in the Caribbean. And his father decided that that's what he was going to follow, Garveyism. And so our elder had a father whose mind was shaped in blackness, considering the times, 1900, what have you. He had a foundation somewhat, and a brave father that, this is the movie that was made about Malcolm X by Spike Lee. And, there's some things with the movie that some of us felt that Spike Lee could have put more into. There's a number of things, but you know, the scene where Klan had come to terrorize, you know, his family. No, in this country, the Wild Wild West was founded on the gun, violence, and the Ku Klux Klan, which is an extension of the state. You know, and they came to be themselves, but they met with staunch resistance, and so that had an impact on Detroit Red, and of course. What we be saying sometimes about the material conditions is what they are today. Imagine the material conditions almost 100 years ago, in the era of the Jim Crow madness on the hills of what we have been taught, minds shaped by this thing called Reconstruction. You know, those material conditions which led to the concrete realities for Malcolm Little. And of course, you know, a lot of us have read his autobiography that was put together by Alex Haley, the same brother who wrote the book Roots, which became a TV series about sort of a portrayal of where he'd come from out of the decadence of slavery. And he spoke a lot of things to Alex Haley. It explained a lot of things. And his childhood and whatnot. And like I said, you know, the movie got, you know, some accuracy, you know, like the scene when he was in school and he wanted to be, you know, somebody brilliant, and his instructor told him, well, you have to think about doing something with your hands, you know, as though black people don't have the brains to function, you know, like a executive or something, you know, on their own business. Well, we proved that wrong. Around the same era with the what is known as the Black Wall Street Tulsa. Mm-hmm. But the material conditions found him in the street hustle after it'd been removed, you know, from the household. He stayed and spent with his, I believe it was his sister. One point, you know, but the street life as it is today, you know, the consumption of the street life, the ulterior motive, so to speak, to survive, you know, to getting it in due to the contradictions of the relationship between black people and the state. Only affording a handful of us to make it, a handful of us to prosper, a handful of us to be allowed access to material luxury and comfort. And that handful in the 20s, the 30s, 40s, was little known now that we know today as in the collegiate world, the black collegiate circuit as the Boule. There's been not too many of us who've taken a look at it. One or two of us have. And, you know, the system of things. And Malcolm had come to understand that in his evolution, and further evolution from Malcolm X to El-Hajj Malik, Shabazz, who was violently taken from us and further known as Saint Omar Wiley. But he began to understand a lot of things, and I was one of them. And he had been speaking in such a way he was trying to help the rest of us during that time to, this Negro faction. And this is not a personal trip, but it's something that has to be put out there to be explained. There's many of us who are followers and small, group of us has developed as leaders. We went through through the ringer, and we went through a process, and it shaped our minds in a way where, it becomes noticeable to other people, and to be able to articulate things in ways to get people to see themselves in the conditions, to see themselves in the struggle. And this is what Malcolm was able to do. Unlike anybody else, as far as I'm concerned, and I'd be willing to bet, even though I'm not a betting man, that there are others who share the same sentiments or similar sentiments. And it's not to say that they didn't have any other brilliant minds, Some people, they would choose W.E.B. Du Bois. I've seen, articles or writings and whatever, books mention him and talk about him and black leaders and, leaders of the whatever, the modern world and 20th century, whatever. And, they place W.E.B. Du Bois at the top, but little, do they do some or most of them understand probably that Du Bois belong to the Boulé. And it becomes problematic, when you go into matters and you go so intricately entombed, peeling layers back like an onion, in order to be able to bottom things out to make sense of it. Like you develop a car problem, your car won't start, and you come out, and you got X amount of time to be to work, and you come out your door, you're on the move, and you get in your car won't crank it. Everything just, all the air goes out the balloon. And so, you want to know why your car not start. Nobody just can't say, get some general information. You really want to know. So you get to the bottom of it, same as peeling layers back of an onion to get to the bottom of it. And that is what some of us have done in this country in this 500-year stint of white terror, of European psychological warfare that is, like in the movie Total Recall, lobotomized our minds, our brains, the colonized mind have turned us into nine beings. Mm-hmm. And people had to, this is thing about 21st century understanding and whatnot. Some people can't believe that this type of thing is still going. It's the 21st. Because they haven't really taken a look, And all these things are saying they're not new. This is what Malcolm X did. This is what he was. In the hustle game even, he was savvy. He was a maneuver, he had savvy on the streets, some people know him as a pimp and a hustler, a dope user or whatever, and whatnot, a robber, a burglar, whatever. He did over 6 years in concentration camp, from 46 to 52. And it was his brother, that would visit him, from time to time or whatever, periodically, and that began to slowly peeled the veil back from over his eyes. You know, in the scene in the Malcolm X movie where they show him in his hole with a dictionary, and his eyes got so they start wearing glasses, and you know, it shut down everything and lights out. You know, everybody was sleeping. Now I'm sitting there with the book and the little speck of light that would come through his through the opening, and he would, you know, hold the book. This is the scene they portray in the movie. And it was fairly accurate. And he had took that dictionary and went from front to back. And so he began to notice things, you know. Just like, you know, like I said, he noticed in the Black Ball, you know, Black Friday, whatever, you know. Things like that, you know, blackmail, you know, and but it was sort of a beginning of before his time, so to speak, you know. But it was his brother that had been in the Nation of Islam. He was a Muslim, and he, you know, turned him on to the teachings of Elijah Muhammad. And from there, you know, he evolved. You know, so when he did his stint, you know, he went to visit Elijah Muhammad. And, you know, he pretty much took him under his wing and, you know, he molded him even more. And it's like, you know, you become a lieutenant, you know, so to speak, in the realm of you know, religion, so-called. You know, ideology of what religion is today, how we understand it. You know, the so-called religion of Islam. There are those who would say that Islam is not a religion, it's a way of life. It's a practice of a way of life. Some people are, you know, this thing they have with Muslim and Islam and in the Christian dominated society, you know, there's always this disparaging connotations for any other religion except Christianity. So, you know, the Muslims have been charged of being idolatrous or whatnot, pagan or whatever, you know. it's amazing, but Muslim is simply mean one who submits his will, you know, to God, who the Muslims know as Allah in the Arabic language. And these are the things that he had embraced, and he cleaned himself up. He was able to clean himself up. The rap group Dead Prayers, where they actually have a rap sort of a song that you know, that just make a contribution to that. You talking about you cleaned up, you know, parts of his mind and his body and whatnot, you know. Stop, you know, eating pork and drinking, you know, Coca-Cola and Shasta and stuff like that, you know. And it's a transformation, 360 degrees, which is something that is also in the spinoff of the Nation of Islam, as a nation of God on earth, a 5% nation. As a result of Bobby Clamor's 13X, if I'm saying that correctly, if I remember. But even with them, you know, cleaning up, you know, the body, the mind, cleansing, you know. And this is what he became. And, you know, his ability he already had on the streets, you know, the charisma, he already possessed, you know, this knack for standing out. You know what I'm saying? That's how you got to be known, the Detroit Red, you know, in the hustle game. You know, he was brave, he was fierce. So he already had these qualities in him. And Elijah Muhammad and the Nation of Islam, the teachings of Islam, the Quran, where it was able to sort of, you know, like terms like, you know, become pristine in thought and stuff, you know, physically, mentally, spiritually. You know, doing the Salat, you know, five times a day is a form of prayer that Muslims do, you know. Some people pray standing up. Some people pray on their knees. Some people pray on the back of their legs, you know, sitting up with their hands on their lap, you know, whatnot, you know, bowing over, bending over and praying and whatever, meditating. You know, Buddhism, Hinduism, sitting up, it was called the lotus position. You know, different forms of prayer, meditation. And he had benefited from this tremendously. And so he combined all those things together, and he became Malcolm X. You know, it was sort of lost and found, tribe of Shabazz. You know, this belief of being a lost, you know, tribe of Shabazz. You know, and so they not knowing their original names or their, you know, their last name, as he explained, you know, last name defines who you are. You know, like your tribe, you know, your clan. You know what I'm saying? And he chose the letter X, you know, which represents the unknown, you know. And that is how he got to be Malcolm X. He rose up through the ranks. And then he became, you know, Elijah Muhammad, you know, number one, you know, representative, you know, whatever you want to, you know, his chief spokesman or whatnot, you know, who go out and articulate the position of the Nation of Islam, its political ideology, religious philosophy, you know, and you know, done a yeoman's job. You traveling around the country, yeah, set up temples around the country, you know, and be what is now referred to as the final call, where it was Muhammad speaks, and all of these was the brainchild of Malcolm X, Muhammad speaks, you know. And he had been teaching younger cats, you know, 17, 18 years old, 19 years old, 20, 21, or whatnot. You know, he's 10 years older than them, 10, 15 years older than them. And they'd been teaching them, you know, tremendously. And, of course, you know, the Nation of Islam's ideology or their belief about the white man, you know, so much. And he internalized, you know, the position, you know, the understanding as being taught by Elijah Muhammad. And there's a number of things, you know, with Elijah Muhammad, you know, his transformation. He had met someone who was supposedly been from the East, what became known as Farad Muhammad, or Farad Muhammad, you know. And Elijah Muhammad was known as Elijah Poole then, before he received his title Muhammad. You know, this is why a lot of brothers of the Nation, brothers in the Nation of Islam, brothers and sisters, you know, brothers of the Nation, in the Nation of Islam, last name is Muhammad. You know, after, of course, you know, Prophet Muhammad, who, you know, the Nation of Islam believed, as Christians believe, their version of Jesus, the return of the Messiah. And so they understood that as the great Mahdi, you know, who would come and usher in, you know, the cleansing, you know, the reestablishment of kingdom, you know, whatever, you know, this heavenly kingdom or whatnot. But anyway, that is how Elijah Muhammad got his start. I believe his name was Wallace D. Farr. He became Farad Muhammad. And he had a question, kind of like a little thing, you know. And Elijah Muhammad, he would instruct Elijah Muhammad on certain things, who he was. And this is what led to Elijah Muhammad to establishing the Nation of Islam, you know, and his structure. Part of that structure too, that most of us who even in the struggle, or the Black Liberation Movement, or the Black Militant Movement today, the various formations, factions, even of Black Panther Party groups, or Black Panther Party oriented groups, including the Peace Political Party, the Black Panther Party Orient, you know what I'm saying, or Guardian Spies, and the Nation of Islam had a 10-point program. And what Huey P. Newton did was adopted the program minus the religious overtones to it. And that's how the Black Panther Party developed the 10-point program. And so the Nation of Islam had this type of structure, which influenced the sort of a setting of points of planks of political understanding in 10 points. And so all these things Malcolm had mastered would become a brain trust, brainchild in a lot of those things. Harlem was the heartbeat. You know, man, it's an amazing place. We put Harlem on the map, or the world, not only in America, but he put Harlem on the map across the world. You know, and you've seen some of his speeches, clips, and whatnot. You know what I'm saying here, and his ability to be able to, paint a portrait, so to speak. You know, you're able to paint a vivid portrait, you know, to get black people to see. And you know, some of us today, we've adapted that. You know, a way of getting people to listen, to really get them to listen, to get them to understand. Kind of careful with some of these terms, you know. I don't want to say, you know, magnetized, because it's rather dangerous, you know what I'm saying? But enough, you know, to, people to gravitate, that's the word, you know, gravitate to you to get people to understand the starting and role of reconstitution, the starting and role of decolonization of mind. And nobody was more fierce at this than Malcolm X. You know, nobody was more fierce than him to develop this ability. And, of course, his chief means was understanding history and studying the enemy. You know, he took the white man and pulled him loose and studied every piece of him. And then you put them back together. And he was an elder that I saw on one of the old talk shows used to come on years ago. And there's an elder named Gil Noble. He had a show like some of these like talk shows today. He was one of the ones who sort of like laid the foundation for black talk show hosts, you know, bring on guests and discuss black issues. And so we had caught up with some of those who had knew Malcolm, who had been physically with him. And there was an elder that was on. She was on and said she had met him in Africa. You know, she was there, you know, doing some work there in Africa. I believe she was in Ghana or something like that. She said she had heard about him and, heard him. But it was when she met him that really, it like grabbed her. And when she was hearing him speak, like right there in the flesh, and the way he was able to articulate things, like, you know, the way he was able to peer through things and get you to see him, unlike anybody else. And a way, you know, strategy sort of even, like, you know, a philosophy sort of type of thing, you know. But she was explaining that when she heard him and he was speaking, and she was like, man, you're dialectic. You know, she said, that's what she told him. She said, man, you're dialectic. You know, and it's not something we daily hear, like, it's not like a usual word, like a common word. You know, when black people, you know, talking, or we have these events and gatherings, meetings of the mind, you know, that word like is almost non-existent. And even among, you know, like these, the black intellectuals, you know, intellectuals who were with us today and even in the past, you know, but I paid close attention, and I never heard any of these dudes coming up from the 80s, you know, whatnot, and this dialectic thing. And so that's how summed them up. And so at some point you start realizing that, yeah, he's dialectic, and these other people, you know, whatever, they're speakers, you know, come like some of them from the church, you know, as ministers and whatnot, you know. Reverend Al Sharpton, Reverend Jesse Jackson, you know, Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, you know, these reverends. You know, the point back then, the church was like a hub of where black people can go and, you know, sort of feel all right or feel safe and, you know, type of organization or, you know, stuff like that. But Malcolm, he come to find, understand, and Malcolm understood was referred to as dialectical materialism. And this is something that had been popularized by the white political theory practitioners, you know, for over 100 years, 100-something years and whatnot, you know, sort of applied method to understanding the whole scheme of things, you know, politics, race, religion, sports, entertainment, business, even sex, you know. And the contradictions that he would lay out, you know. For instance, when he was talking about how the white man claimed he was over there in Vietnam trying to liberate and bring democracy, and he's here treating his own people in the same way he accusing, you know, the people over there doing their people. And he would point that out. He would expose the contradiction, and then he would heighten them. He would heighten the contradictions. You know, he would point, I mean, just one after the next. You talk about George Washington, and this is something I've latched on to myself. You know, the fact that George Washington had the nerve to claim that he was being, you know, that he was under tyranny. You know, the American people, the newly found America, you know, was under tyranny. King George was referred to as a tyrant. You know, had the audacity to claim being under tyranny, and yet he was a slave owner. He could not see other human beings the efforts. You know, so how could he dare talk about democracy? How could he dare talk about liberty and life and whatever pursuit of happiness, all the kind of shit, and whatnot? You know, or the rights of man and all this kind of stuff under the roof of God. And that's amazing. And this is what he would do. And then he would turn to his own people. You know, you look at his own people, and he would, you know, point out the contradictions in the leadership and in the position. Here you have the Klan and the violence and lynchings. And Gandhiism was a contradiction, you know, to that. And Bayard Rustin was the one who took Martin Luther King under his wing and instructed him in Gandhiism, you know, nonviolent approach. You know, when you had the Klan, it was lynching people. You know, in the early beginnings. You know, all the way up. You know, in the 60s and whatnot. You know, and even the day. You know, these high tech lynchings. The lynching of George Floyd. You know what I'm saying? And it was similar. We see today. But that's what he would do. You know, so that's what made him dialectic. You know, he could take that. He could take the situation. And he'll pierce the situation, and then he'll give you the opposing ends of it. And he'd sum it up and say, okay, well, if it's this, then you have to be like that. In other words, you're saying you're not going to be nonviolent with somebody that's violent towards you. You can only be nonviolent with people who are peaceful towards you. It makes perfect sense. You know, he will point out the kind of addiction between the house nigga and the field nigga. You know, the house nigga, the master get sick, the house nigga come running and say, what's wrong, boss or master, we sick, house on fire, the house nigga come running and he'll knock over, he'll even knock over the master who trying to get the water and put the fire out. Field nigga would be out there in the field, you know, toiling from can't see in the morning, can't see at night, and look around and see the house catching on fire. And so he stop everything he's doing and get down on his knees and pray. And you pray that a strong wind will come and make it even worse. You know, so you pointed out the contradictions, you know, between the house nigga and the field nigga, and that the house nigga was on deluding himself. He thought that if he thought that the master was fair, You know, he wore the master's closest clothes, you know, the hand-me-downs. That was considered, you know, being, you know, dressing nice, you know, and the slaves, you know, the field niggas, those I taught, you know, they wore, the rags, you know. These terms have never left us. You know what I'm saying? Man, look at them rags, you know. These terms have never left us. You know, ragtime music, it never left us. You know, the Reconstruction era. You know, the blues, you know, it never left us. You know what I'm saying? It never left us. You know, blues became a form of music in the music, black music circuit, black music culture. You know, Malcolm would point all these things out. He was speaking in ways that, people, you know, wished that they could be. And so a lot of envy developed, you know, along the way, you know, internally and externally. You know, but the one thing that he kept stressing to the people and to those who were inspired to be the next leaders, or who had the ability, you know, to people to gravitate, and he was look, he would tell them, you know, you must understand history, the historical process. You know, you understand the things you do, you don't make no sense of them. You know, because you understand, you realize you were a colonized man with a colonized mind, or a colonized woman with a colonized mind. So therefore, your children will have colonized minds. You know, and until there's a opening, a window of opportunity, only for a few. And so, like I said earlier, the few have become a sort of a cabal. You know, and I use these terms because, you know, the enemies use these terms to, you know, to label non-whites in these categories and categorize them because they're the enemy, because they're the opposing forces. But such terms as cabal or cliques or whatnot. And, you know, Malcolm had gotten wind of that. He studied. He realized what power is. And that is like almost cornering the market. You know, he was talking about power. You know, he said, look, he said about power and what's the foundation? Like, you get the power, you can control the land. You know, and so he said, what is it about? He said, this is a antagonism over land. You know, land is the basis to a person or a people's freedom. You know, and you know, even if you study those of us, and we, you know, we've taken a look at these leaders and whatnot, you go back and listen to clips of all of them, and you will see a difference. You know, we're not talking about power the way Malcolm was talking about power. He was hip to, these handful of rich white families that had become famous. Of course, the Rockefeller family had become the most famous family, you know, of them all. You know, so next to like the Ford family and whatnot, you know, the Carnegie family, you know, you see now you these programs, philanthropy, and you always see them at the top of philanthropy given. You know, the Ford Foundation, Carnegie Foundation and whatnot, you know. And this is what he was hip to. And the same thing he was hip to is what his father was hip to with Garvey. And Garvey was hip to the same thing. You know, so he had it in him. He had it in him. It was just a matter of time before it became like pristine, became, you know, chiseled. And that's what he had become. And so he was speaking on the level at a astronomical level that set him apart from everybody else. And if it set him apart from everybody else, it set him apart from black, brown, red, yellow, and white. You know? So years go by. You become real critical. And like I said, you know, he took the white man to lose, examined every part of him, put him back together, and then, you know, he's getting people to understand, look, if you don't teach you right, then what makes you think he's going to teach you right? You know, he'll lock you up for public drunkenness. You know, you break the seal of that whiskey bottle, but he won't block up the whiskey company people for producing. So you point out the contradictions. You see, you talk about accumulation of capital. You know, in the accumulation of capital, now you keep your foot on another man's neck. turn around and tell you that he's somehow going to come and free you and liberate you. He's going to return, and he's going to free you at the same time. And so he would take those contradictions over and over, he would heighten them. And so Whitey, you know, began to realize that he was having a problem. Elijah Muhammad had become old. You know, so it was Malcolm. And so internal things, you know, had started growing and bending there. And so in 1963, November 22nd, I believe, shots rang out, and America lost his beloved president, John F. Kennedy. You know, John Fitzgerald Kennedy, one of the most beloved presidents of America, of white America, and even black folks. You know, you can see footage of black people crying just as profusely as white people crying. You know, at the hearing the death of their president by Walter Cronkite of CBS. You know, Malcolm haven't already understood violence. He understood the history of America. And this was passed down to H. Rap Brown. Well, H. Rap Brown, you know, he talked about, when you speak in a little press conference thing, talking about violence, Americans are apple pie. And his old saying, America's three greatest pastimes, baseball, blue skies, and apple pie. No. And that's a conditioning. It was automatic. It was already etched in my brain. I didn't have to hesitate to say it. It was internalized. You know, the American culture, the American way, you know, united way, you know what I'm saying? And having understood the cycle of violence, the level of violence, and here we go again, you know, the dialectic, the historical materialist perspective of the law of nature, you know, what the Hindus refer to as karma, you know, as opposed to dharma. You know, when you're treating people with benevolence, when you practice dharma internally, you will practice dharma externally with those around you, regardless of what their skin color was or what they looked like, or what land or country or language they spoke. You know, and that's dharma. And so, having realized that the Europeans had never been any particular group that practiced dharma. Like talking about it, you know, even understanding, you know, Malcolm understood, you know, Greece and Rome. Matter of fact, I've committed a let me kind of go back a little bit here. There's so much, but forgive me for not having you know, brought in his queen into the picture, you know, at some point. Of course, you know, in his evolution, when he started, he was in the nation, and that stage when he was teaching and building, and you know, it was like, okay, well, you know, you got to complete yourself. You're not complete. You know what I'm saying? You only got, you know, half the picture, so you must become complete. And the only way you become complete, you have to get him, you know, you find your better half, you know. And have you Betty Shabazz, you know, interviews over the years and whatnot, you know, she'd speak on how, you know, people were really interested, like, you know, I don't know if she might have been on Oprah one time or something, but and people really wanted to know, like, you know, how'd you meet him, how'd you start, what did he say to you, you know, stuff like, you know, women be wanting to know stuff like that, you know. And now, you know, she said, well, you know, he was this, that, he was that, you know, and I was like, yeah, you know, he, like we say today, you know, sisters say today about a brother, you know, he had it going on, you know, and it was, rest was history, you know. And, you know, so, you know, she gave him a whole gang of daughters, you know. And I wanted to say that for this, when he was talking about, you know, history, and he understood, you know, the empires, you know, the how empires rise and they fall due to their contradictory nature. And this is what happened to the Romans. And when you were talking about how Attila the Hun, you know, had expanded westward, you know, and he terrorized the West, you know, and, you know, some people renounce it Attila the Hun. Other people renounce it Attila. You know, and as a result of that, this is how one of his daughters had got her name, you know. And, you know, he would, you know, he would kind of like laugh, you know, he would make light of the Romans, you know, due to the contradictory nature of the Roman Empire and ambitions, the slavery during that time in the Roman Empire. You know, they've tried to make these movies over the years and whatnot. They made the movie of Spartacus and how Spartacus tipped over the cup. And that was the beginning of the end of the Roman Empire. You know, so we was like, well, you know, black people, now we need a black Spartacus. You know, and so Malcolm rose to that potential as a black Spartacus. And, of course, the Caesar, you know, during those times, you know, Eisenhower and whatnot. You know, there was a modern-day version of Caesar, you know, and the establishment of the American Empire. Vietnam, you know, and so that is what he understood, and he would apply the same method, the same understanding to black people in America, and of course coupled with, you know, books and literature and stuff he had read, the Nation of Islam, Elijah Muhammad's writings and his understanding. He wrote a book called Message to the Black Man, you know, along the way, you know, and a lot of us in the '80s, you know, we come up, you know, we read that book and we were grasping the ideology, political ideology, of religious philosophy, the Nation of Islam, or the views on who the white man is and whatnot, you know, and this is what Malcolm had been doing, but understanding the blowback of the history of violence on the parts of whites, and that one day it would come to bite them in the ass. And so that is how Malcolm saw John F. Kennedy's assassination. Now anybody would take a good look at that, you know, they could understand. You know, that, you know, it's a rational thought, it's a rational process. You know, anybody who listens, you want a question, comment, you know, press the one on your phone, we'll get you, you know, in the queue, you know, for you, you know, want to come on and speak, question the time, or whatever, feel free to do so. This in defense of People Radio, People's Radio, you know what I'm saying? We, like I said, we use a political education platform, you know, to heighten our people's conscience, to turn blind rage into conscious power. And this is a process, a struggle process, part of the struggle, you know. But anyway, that didn't sit too well with, you know, Elijah Muhammad. You know, and some was, you know, when, you know, in the 90s, so to speak, you know, in the Malcolm X movie, we had a problem with that. You know, we had a problem with, we couldn't get why, you know, he would want to, you know, they would want to sit, you know, the man down to the side, you know. And we was like, right on. But a different type of thought, you know, that Elijah Muhammad shared, you know, about the sentiments of, you know, these white people and whatnot, you know, American people, you know, how they love this man and whatnot, you know. And, you know, it's always a slippery slope, you know. Sometimes you have to really be careful even with some of these things, you know, that, it was, you know, it was an old thing where, like, you could line 20 people up and let the person come over and whisper something in the first person here and tell him to pass it on. And by the time you get down to the 20th person, the chance is that what was originally whispered in the first person here had got altered by the time it made it to the 20th person's ear. You know. And, but, you know, that was the problem. And so it became a dichotomy. It was perceived that Malcolm had spoke prematurely, or he was reacting, a spontaneous reaction, as though he was glad that Kennedy was dead, and you or you know, he can celebrate or whatnot. You know, the perception. But what he said is a valid point. You know? But anyway, that is what led to his breaking away the precipitation of it, at least. I've been told, you know, by those who were in the know or knew somebody, and you know, I don't know if they're all in the book. Some of these things don't get to be certain person that knows certain things, you know, that I didn't read, you know, about Malcolm, whatever, even digging deep and searching, you know, as one of my heroes, you know, try to understand him, listen to his speeches, you know, sitting, you know, at night or laying in my bed at night, you know, with earphones on back in the gym. We had tape recorders and cassette tapes, you know, just listening to his speeches, you know, 2-3 in the morning and whatnot, you know. I'm not trying to personalize this, but just the influence on myself, you know. But that was like something that, you know, put the writing on the wall, so to speak. You know, and of course, you know, you listen or you read tapes or speeches and clips where you're talking about, well, the real reason, so-and-so, you know, that Elijah Muhammad was afraid that I'm going to, you know, this exposure. And it's a problematic thing, you know. And I remember one time when Betty Shabazz was on one of the talk shows, and what they tried to do was they actually tried to do the same tactic and strategy that they use with Huey P. Newton and Eldridge Cleaver, where they get them on the national syndicated show live, and then they have, you know, Eldridge call in from Algeria, and you know how they do. But not like what's her face, Ellen DeGeneres, you know, where she, you know, she have a guest on and whatnot, and then they, you know, call somebody at random or like that, you know, on the phone, stuff like that. But that's the strategy. And so I think it was on NBC, and so they had on, and then you know, he's asking these certain questions, like these sort of slick like type questions, you know. But he asked her like, okay, well, what did he do wrong? You know, he said this, he said that, and how you, or Malcolm has said to say this, or he did this, he did all these things and whatnot. And she said, what I want to know is what did he do wrong? You know, she looked right into the camera and said, well, I want to know what did he do wrong? You know, and that's what a lot of us, that's what we came away with ourselves, you know. You know, as an understudy, there's a master and an understudy, you know, a teacher and a disciple, so to speak, right, and a student. And you mold somebody, you know, you instruct them. And what are the things that you mold and instruct them? You know, walk a straight line, you know, one woman's many, you know, be monogamous, you know, there's nothing wrong with that at all, period. You know, as old saying, be careful what you teach your children. You can come back around and haunt you at a later point in time when they grow up and get old. You know, and we're seeing a lot of that today. But, you know, Malcolm, he took that wholeheartedly. He took every bit of it. He didn't take 99.99%. He took that 0.01 that was left with. He took it whole. He internalized. It was in his heart. In his heart, in his psyche, in his mind, in his spirit, in his soul. So, I over the years have tried to wonder, well, what's the big deal? Like, you know, this is what you raised me to be. And I turn around and look, you know, you're doing the opposite of what you're telling me to be, you know. And there's been a number of things over the years, you know. I've discussed things with people, or even some brothers I know in the Nation of Islam, you know, whatever, though. But I still try to figure out how it's so problematic, you know. But that became the gas, you know, the light to the gas, you know, with Malcolm and the, you know, split with the Nation of Islam. And but the rank and file in the Nation of Islam didn't see it that way. They saw it as another thing. And I'm gonna tell you. This is the part where some people may feel as dangerous, or the projection of somebody onto somebody else, so to speak. You know, but you know, they saw it different. You know, Elijah Muhammad was, how should we say it, you know, like baby Jesus, so to speak. You know? And they had him in another life. And so it was an exception to the rules, so to speak, you know, because of who he was, you know, divine, so to speak, you know. And there was a comparison with Solomon in the Bible. You know, the attempted, you know, to justify it or rationalize, you know. Solomon has 700 wives. You know, this is what I've heard or I've discussed or seen and whatnot, you know, the different lines of thought, you know, to rationalize what would seem to be Malcolm as, you know, unrational. You know? And so this is why Betty Shabazz, what did he do wrong? You know, I don't know if it was a challenge or whatever, you know. But, and of course, you know, his daughters over the years, you know, they grew in coming to the world and, you know, the terror of all but two at the time. You know, it was assassination, you know, it was political murder, state back murder. You know? And that was the thing that drove, you know, a sort of a war, you know, and there was one individual at the time, you know, named Louis X. We can't, you know, today, you know, Louis Farrakhan, the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan, was now the leader of Nation Islam. And you know, the reality of it all, you know, that he was one of the individual persons, you know, calling for, you know, Malcolm's death, or the same thing, his tongue should be cut out or whatnot, you know, and served on a platter or whatever, light him out, you know, and it got that beat. Some of them saw that, or you can make the, you know, the correlation in the Bible where, they're sitting around, and I believe it was John the Baptist, with Peter, one of them, and they were sitting there, and Jesus was there, and he was talking, and one of the some, you know, one of the persons had you know, kind of in their view got a bit, you know, out of line or whatnot, or frisky with Jesus, and you know, he picked up the sword, and I think the sword, he cut that person man's ear off or whatever. And Jesus had to reprimand him, you know. And that is how, you know, it was with Elijah Muhammad. You know, he had person in the Nation of Islam, and let's be clear about it. We were willing to kill at the snap of, you know, of a thing, you know. And this is why a lot of people don't believe that, you know, Elijah Muhammad was oblivious to it, or he was outside of it, you know. So, you know, you know, these things don't come, they're structuring the nation. They don't, or, you know, things just don't happen out of a vacuum. They had to come from the top, so to speak. You know? But, you know, and over the years, you know, there's been times where Farrakhan has gone on different formats and discussed that, you know. And he even admit that he may have been or whatever responsible for that tone that was set or whatever, you know. And you know, which led partially to his assassination. And of course, you know, we cannot speak about his assassination without Time and Touch this program. You know, without the FBI's role, without the FBI's part in the whole thing. And it's so much, you know, but in fact, what we wanted to just speak about the man, you know, talk about the man, you know, dedicate this show to him. And rightfully so, because he's responsible for some of us today. You know, I'm one of those. He's responsible for who I am. I don't hesitate to say that. I'm not afraid to say it. You know, there's some who went to Harvard, you know, and you know, so-called major, and they'll tell you that Clarence Thomas was responsible for that. Colin Powell is responsible, you know, for the dude who's the head military man in Africa under this empire military thing called Africa. And he may tell you that it's because of Colin Powell saying he did, that he's dead. You know, the head of the command of AFRICOM in Africa. The continent, not the country. The continent. So, you know, yeah. You know, and it is what it is. Yeah, there's some cats on the street, young cats on the street, Mississippi shit. Man, look, man, you know, dying wine. You know, it's not my hero. You know what I'm saying? Iceberg Slim. You know, real cat. It is what it is. In sports. You know, some of these dudes wear the number of the dude played football when he was a little boy. And they made it to the NFL, running back, whatever, quarterback, and they're wearing the number of their favorite player that played when he was a boy. And Lord, don't let them having to make it to the league and they heroes still playing in the league, and then they wind up playing against him in the game. That's like his crowning moment, besides winning the Super Bowl, you know. So that's what it is. So he's responsible for a lot of us, you know. And I'm glad to be here doing this radio show, leader of the People's Political Party, you know. Again, you know, Panther-oriented, Garvey-inspired, and with Malcolm in the middle. You know, the Black Panther Party considered the children of Malcolm X. He influenced them. You know, he was very clear. He, you know, his ideology, the way he thought, the sharpness of his mind. Fred Hampton, even, in the scene in the movie The Judas and Black Messiah, but who's seen it, he's in the room right now. He's, you know, he's a little notepad and a pen, and he's, you know, in the room kind of going back and forth. And he's sitting. And he leans up against the dresser or whatnot, and he's quoting Malcolm. He's, you know, he's quoting him. You know, he's memorizing Malcolm, stuff like that. It is what it is, you know. And this is what made him so great. You know, it made him so great. What made it went into the makeup of Fred, of Chairman Fred, and Chairman Fred Singh. You know, this. pacing back and forth thing, you know, and you know, memorizing, you know. So when he goes speak to the people, he'd be able to put it, you know, to the people. And leader Chairman Fred Hampton Jr., you know, leader of the chairman of Black Panther Cubs, you know, is a habit of doing it himself, you know. you know, I've seen that, you know, with my own eyes, you know, but it's a legacy, it's an influence, you know, what made him so great. But his assassinations, I like to say that Malcolm was the precipitation to the revolution, you know, before he was violently taken from us. When he transformed for Malcolm X, so to speak, to El Hajj Malik Shabazz. He made his Hajj, you know, the Mecca. Every Muslim is, you know, is required to make the Hajj to Mecca at least once in their lifetime, you know, the great mosque in Mecca, you know, and the, you know, the visit the Kaaba, you know, and whatnot, you know, and rub your hand on a black stone that sits in a corner of the Kaaba shrine, you know. And actually, you know, in the Malcolm X movie, you know, they, you know, they, Spike Lee, you know, portrays that in the movie. You know what I'm saying? And, you know, his expansion of mind. And I think this is the problem, you know, where people have a problem. You know, some people feel that Malcolm was a contradiction. calling a white man the devil, and then made us hide, and, you know, you, like you said, the Alex Haley, you know, he was dead, and this is what made him believe that Islam was the only religion that could bring all the races together, because he saw it with his own, you know, all the different colors of men together. And you said that he was sitting there, you know, that palest white man he can be ever seen in his life. And he was sitting there, you know, drinking out the same vessel. You know? And they were all one. And some people take that and say, well, how can a white man be the devil and you drinking behind him, you right next to him? So people looked at that and said, well, he's contradiction. Ivy Rose, KRS-One. Nas ran scream over nearly everyone. One of the greatest MCs of hip hop all time, years ago, I believe in the 90s, he was on the show and he was asked about Malcolm. And he was like, you know, I don't really, you know, it's like, you know, he turned Malcolm loose or he see contradiction, so to speak. You know, where I was looking at it in the expansionist sort of mind, the larger world, the larger society. His full, complete growth, you know, in the world, due to a religious ideology. And I think that has been wiped out of the picture. You know, we're all ideological fiends in some way, form, or shape, or another. Every last one of us is affected by some type of ideology, whether we like it or not. Whether we like, we're affected by some type of ideology, we're affected by it. So nobody's exempt from that. It's an interrelationship, it's an interaction with other human beings in society. You know, there's developments of things in society that go high, like stages of civilization and whatnot, you know? But the one that he, I'll challenge anybody on this, that the fact that he never relinquished the idea of black people and self-determination like Garveyism, black nationalism. No. And that was very clear. He came back from Africa, Organization of African Unity. We had met leaders in Africa and with the white man that called the Middle East. And it was so clever by him that he consciously visited countries that he knew America was dependent on for natural resources. And I don't think a lot of us, you know, realize that either or aware of it. You know, but consciously, it just wasn't just a happenstance thing. He just ended up in the country or just realized they had oil. Or he ends up, he realized that they had uranium, you know, whatnot. No. Consciously, by design. Because he'd done his homework, he studied history, you know, imperialism, the history of imperialism, what it does, what it's about, capitalism, what it does, what it's about, how it turns people into non-beings, it turns people into things, to start becoming human, and then they have to win their humanity back, but not without revolution, not without the revolutionary transformation of society. And so when he said, okay, well, he scathed an attack on the Big Six, the Boule. You know, and we have that today, you know, but everything you said, was it not true? Was it false when he spoke with the Big Six? I've learned, you know, I've had people like tell me over the years, maybe it's how you say things sometimes, you know what I'm saying? Or it's not what you say. It's how you saying it. And that may be true most of the time, if not all the time. You know what I'm saying? But he would point these things out. And that did a lot of us good because it taught us what we understand now is her, you know, this Hegelian strategy. The left and the right hand appearing to be adversaries externally out in the open. In front of the camera, you know, and I'll give you a classic example of that, Democrats and Republicans. You know, this thing with Donald Trump and the Russians and Putin, you know, the Democrats all over, know, and then all of a sudden, they can't handle it now because Biden, son Hunter Biden, and the Russians and Putin, business ventures and business. What's the difference? What's the difference? What's the difference? You know, and it's a ruse. It's a game. Ruse. What is a ruse? R-U-S-E. You know, somebody's running a ruse, you know. And that's what it is. And that's a Hegelian strategy. You know? And Malcolm was that sharp. And he was able to point it out. You know, when you talk about the Big Six. You know, the people who are in power have, you know, things like NGOs, non-government organizations, think tanks and whatnot, foundations and groups. And so what? You know, the fact that Malcolm pointed out how certain families had money to the tune of hundreds of thousands of dollars and that they would divvy this money up between themselves, you know. The people are following, and the people have the right to know.
Black Power, Chairman.
You know what I'm saying? Yeah, yeah, Conrad, we got.
Got a call.
Go ahead. Okay, yeah. Caller, where you calling from? Give us your name, your name, where you calling from, and question and comment.
Sure, Richard, USA. Look, I'm just, are you taking comments on anything that you have to say? You and I spoke a while ago. I wanted to reference capitalism because I heard you say something just now. You denigrated capitalism. But would you like to discuss that, or is that possible?
No. It's not possible here to spend the whole conversation on old capitalism. Let me just say this here.
Sure.
What I said was, and if you want to take this as denigrating capitalism, that's fine with me. But what I said was that Malcolm understood what capitalism does people. Okay, he understood that. He recognized what imperialism was and what it does people. And so when he went overseas, he understood the white ruling class's ambitions and that in order to run an empire, like a car needs gas and oil. Okay, so he knew that. And so he figured, like Garvey did, well, Africa for the Africans. Europeans say Europe for the Europeans. You don't see East Asians, Pacific Islanders, damn sure enough not no Arabs and Muslims going to Europe and dictating and taking all the what they got and bringing it back to their own homelands, now without some problems. So he recognized that, and that's what capitalism is, the free market, free enterprise, free trade, and that's what it does. And look, this not me. This is history. And check it out. White people, whether they're atheists, Marxists, capitalists, Christian, whatever you want to call it, they've even pointed it out. They've even shown it. And so it's a cancer. Now, if that's your brand, if that's your cup of tea, then you roll with it. But see, what we understand is that indigenous black and brown people didn't need capitalists to come and civilize them. They didn't need no capitalists to come show them how to run a political economy. What the capitalists did was they came and held up progress. They came and stunted it. They stopped it, like Cabral said, in West Africa. That's what I said. But if you take it as a denigration, then that's something you have to deal with. But we're not going to spend the whole show the rest of the way discussing capitalism. Now, you want to, comment. On that, we give you a couple of minutes to respond.
Well, sure, thank you. And I would just like to say, you know, and neither one of us, I think it's good for people not to be in their egos so that they can really see the issues clearly. Look, you are living on a capitalistic platform if you're in the United States. And capitalism is something that touches, because it's an economic system, it touches everything that you do. Now, a lot of people aren't good at it, but it is the best system going. And all the systems that are in place are, you know, put in place by man. But capitalism at its heart deals with supply and demand and people working hard, showing creativity, and, of course, getting compensated for it. Now, you know, a lot of people think complaining will put them in a place of comfortableness. I say usually it won't. And so I think one's understanding of capitalism, and particularly the economic system that undergirds them, is very crucial to their getting ahead in life. You know, we go to school to get a trade or some sort of profession, thereby we can trade that for money so that we can enhance our lives. So I just think
stop
that.
Right, yeah, go ahead, stop with that. We don't have much time, but I want to stop you right there. Right there. Okay. Now, Malcolm X stated in so many words that you want to go to school, get a degree, make something of yourself, study this and study that field of this and field of that, fine. Go do it. As long as you bring it back and you lift up your own people, like every other group in this country is doing, and around the world.
Well, what if those people aren't available to be lifted up? See, assuming that everybody wants to grow. Some people.
No. Wait. Stop.
Okay, go ahead. I hear you.
By nature, everybody grows. Everybody grows by nature. It's a natural law. It's a law of nature. Everybody grows. It's when you become, like I said earlier, and Malcolm recognizes. I'll use a term in a movie called Total Recall. It's when you become lobotomized, you stop wanting to grow. Nobody comes out of their mother's womb and don't want to grow. You have to alter that in order for them to stop wanting to grow, which therefore, I said it earlier, which Malcolm recognized, they become non-beings. And when you become a non-being, you become a dead man. When you become a dead man, you become unproductive.
Okay, let me ask you a question.
Now you said, Hold on, wait a minute. You said capitalism is a great thing going. I disagree because you hear, America is not the earth. It is not the world. That is your white arrogance that does that. America is not the world.
Okay, but before you get too far, I want to question something that you said, if you don't mind.
Hold on, wait a minute. Hold on. I'm going to end it with this right here. America is a small place on the planet. There are other systems on this earth where people are living. They just don't get exposure. Have you ever heard of Ubuntu?
No.
Okay, that's what I'm talking about. Now, what's your question?
Well, what is it? I mean, don't just ask me a question without informing me.
Well,
what
Ubuntu is an old indigenous way of relationship economically, politically, socially, spiritually, and everything else that still exists in Africa. So much so that a white American basketball team developed a winning formula after having one losing season after the next. And you know how they got to start winning? They adopted Ubuntu.
Okay.
So it
okay,
must be
well,
some
thank you
kind
for that.
So it must be some kind of good for a white basketball team. So this is what I'm saying to you. It's the same old thing over and over again. But go ahead, what's your question? We don't have much time.
Two things. First of all, Farrakhan, I listen to him. He makes sense on a lot of the things that he says. Now, he practices capitalism. He's a very wealthy man. Farrakhan, he's probably in the top, he's in the top 1% of Americans. But look here, I would like to disabuse you of the notion that everybody wants to grow. Every culture has prisons, okay? There are lazy people in every culture. There are people who just refuse to understand what the culture is about. That is, how to navigate the culture. In other words, some people prefer to be aberrant or dysfunctional. So I wouldn't agree with you that everybody wants to go the right way automatically. Okay.
No. Stop right there. So wait. Now, you said that some people, basically, they want to be dysfunctional, right? Am I understanding that as
yes.
correct?
Some people choose to be dysfunctional.
Now, some people choose to be dysfunctional. Now, what's the predicate of that?
Well, the predicate, okay, first of all, let me say this. Every country has jail. Wait a minute. Let me make something clear. I want to clarify my point.
I just wanted to, I don't want to spend too much time.
I appreciate you, so I'm not being hostile.
I was asking the question, what's the predicate? That's all. Because like I was saying, like Malcolm transformed himself. What was the predicate?
Right.
The teachings of Islam was the predicate, which is why he said when he went to Mecca and he saw black, brown, red, yellow, and white, you know, so to speak, right? And he drew the conclusion, well, Christianity ain't been able to do this. But Islam appears to be able to do it because there's thousands of us here. Right? So that's a conclusion he drew, a conclusion that concluded, an explanation that explained. But you're not able to explain why, as you say, some people choose to be dysfunctional.
Well, let's deal with Malcolm himself. I think Malcolm is a good exhibit A. Malcolm came out of jail, out of prison. He educated himself, and he became a great leader for that time. Okay, would you concur with that?
Yeah, but there were processes involved in what you're saying. He just didn't.
Wait. Yeah, there were processes, but the number one process was his will. He wanted to change his life, and so he did.
That's not necessarily correct. It's when
how is it incorrect?
If you were listening early to begin, I said it was his brother that came, started visiting him, and slowly but surely started peeling back the veil over Malcolm's eyes. Now, so much so to the point that when he came into the light from darkness, 360 degrees transformation, right, that America needs, right? Now, what did he say when he got up there? He said the same thing. He said, listen, you see, our people are so messed up that you can't just bum rush them with a whole lot of knowledge all at once because it'll overwhelm them. So what you must do, peel the veil back, slowly back in the beginning, and just allow a little light to come in so they can understand and know and learn how to receive the light first, not get the light. They got to learn. It's a process. None of us just leapfrogged into this kind of thing. Now, some of us grew faster than others, but there's a predicate, there's a point to it, there's a point of origin. And see, we don't play them games. We don't just jump off into the sea. No, first of all, what's in the water? What's the temperature of the water? How deep is the water? That's the first questions. Those are the first questions. We just dive in here. Now, some other group, some other friends, they may do that, but we don't do it. See, we're the descendants. We're the political, ideological descendants of people like Malcolm X. And, of course, eventually it will be a problem, as always. You know, Patrick Henry said, give me liberty, give me debt.
Let me respond to you just briefly, sir. First of all, let me say it this way. The world does not owe you or me understanding. I hear what you just said, but I'm going to say this It depends on the source from which the information is coming. You know, if a person tells me there's a bag of gold over, you know, at such and such place, whether they yell that to me, send a smoke signal, any kind of way I can understand it, that would potentially be valuable to me. The person who is receiving and who needs the information doesn't get to dictate how it arrives. They need to, you've heard the old adage, when the student is ready, the teacher will appear. So people who tend to be excessively sensitive, which I'm going to say oftentimes it's their ego, they're going to be ass out because no one has to wait around until they're ready for whatever it is that is being provided to them. So, you know, these snowflakes and people who are super hypersensitive are just not going to, you know, get on board because the world is moving. You and I have
to... I have to stop you right there because we run out of time.
Okay. Well, look, thank you. I'll hang out in the queue, and it's been a pleasure speaking with you.
All right, cool. Right on. No, I just want to say this here. You're right, and it's the same thing applies to the dominant group that has the power. There will be casualties. There will be as casualties in every war. You know, look. We take a independent approach and a thought process. Some of us have learned to take our minds back. Okay, to on the path of reclaiming our humanity. Taking our lives back in our own hands, and it's a process. Okay, now in the midst of that, we understand that it will be casualties because this is war. We don't define what war is in European terms. We define what war is due to through experience as people of African descent from here to the continent, to the motherland. That's how we define war. Europeans define war in the traditional orthodox way. You know, military uniform, weapons issue, training, air, land, and sea, and the usual combat in the theater of war. Okay, yeah, that's a European understanding because war is what? What is politics? Politics is war without bloodshed. Okay, and so it's the politics first. And the positive simply says that if no acquiescing, then we must go to war. If there's no agreement on our terms, then we must go to war. And we have to put a predicate to that war. So therefore, we must create a condition in order for it to be war. We understand that very clearly. That's a Machiavellian strategy. And George Bush, Cheney, and as dumb as George Bush is, Cheney, Scumsfeld, and all the rest of them. See, we know the image is everything. We know that words, expressions, terminology, labels mean the world to the dominant group. That's why nigga is so prevalent. It's so prevalent. And these are the same things that Malcolm was trying to get our people to understand back then. What I said earlier about the house nigga and the field nigga, or the house Negro and the field Negro, because somehow people have a problem with the word nigga. And that's due to a 500-year irreconcilable relationship with the dominant group. But there's blowback for everything. And this is what Malcolm was trying to explain. This is what he said. And he said it's about land. And he was very clear when the reporter asked him about what's the price of freedom. He said debt is no different than what Patrick Henry said. Patrick Henry said, give me liberty or give me debt. And the new Black Panther Party has only a patch. It says freedom or debt. Freedom or debt. George Washington had the same sentiments. He felt the same way. Him, Alexander Hamilton, Thomas Jefferson, and all the rest of the white rapist slave masters. John Quincy Adams, all of them, they had the same attitude. They felt the same way. Today we call it a feeling some kind of way. But because it's a Black man, a person of color, a non-white Anglo-Saxon Protestant, it's problematic. Now all of a sudden it's sedition. It's Black hate. It's narrow-mindedness. It's romanticism. No. We understand what's called falling for the okie doke. And this is what the Nation of Islam meant, Elijah Muhammad meant, what Malcolm X had internalized, what Elijah Muhammad was talking about, the white man himself. that the white man was an antithesis of the original man of the planet who was a black man. So therefore, that made him the devil. So now, here's the question. When you take a look at history and size the white man up and you place him under a category, and I'm going to give you two of them because you ain't got but two. Good or evil? God or the devil? Take your pick. But we very clear, and we wanted to dedicate this show to St. Omar Wiley. He's our hero. All groups of people, ethnic groups, what do you call, got their heroes. Hell, the Venezuela got Hugo Chavez. The Sandinistas was named after Sandino. The Zapatistas were named after Zapata. That was their hero. You got what's called George Washington Day. You got what's called Columbus Day, who was a terrorist, the original terrorist. So there's blowback from that. The Bible even says it. You reap what you sow. You can run, but you can't hide. It is what it is. It's a law of nature. I don't have to make this up. The problem has been when the black man comes along, he's thrown into some type of a category. And ain't but one way to go for him, his liberation or his assassination. So I'm going to end on that piece right there, on that part right there. Man, it is what it is. Live and direct, In Defense of the People Radio, brought to you by People's Political Party. We are a revolutionary organization.
The moment that is bound to shape the future.
Straight up. And so we say black power to black people, in particular to all privacy people, and you who rule. Stay tuned next week. We will be
the moment that is bound to shape the future.
Straight up.
I got a letter from the government the other day. I opened and read it. They telling me to get it. It said that the message I was bringing brought destruction. I put the pants in the bag and said, fuck them. Here's a land that never gave a damn about a brother like me from the jump. They'd rather see me slump. Face down, shot 5 or 6 times with my kid and her mama in the cop car crying. And I'm done. Stop lying. It's a black and white thing. Redneck ass judge. Who's rather watch a nigga hang than indict what's white, not right. Fuck a news feed. Black man got the same needs as the Jews need. Who me? I demand reparations. Fuck a cowboy. I'm a native, robbed of a nation. I'm an African. Black man, fuck out my language. Got me praying to a white boy God. That's insane. And if you ask me why they steadily harass me, I reply with that these motherfuckers nasty. And I'm a god, yet they calling me a nigga. They scared of me, so they try to hide behind the trigger, acting badass. Fuck a honky with the badge. I'm a nigga with an attitude. You can kiss my black ass. Ain't no sense in niggas being diplomatic. Televise the revolution. Let these motherfuckers have it. I'm calling up the homies. They said to come through. And I run with the niggas. They scared to come shoot. Take an eye for an eye. Take a tooth for tooth. Do unto others as some others would do all to you. And now they say it make America great. What America hates, kept America straight and America safe. Motherfuck that flag. My people are not free. We wanna touch that flag. So quick to try to copyright what came for free. Now they blaming me, and it's plain to see that they mad at that. Like I'm a magic act. Yeah, imagine that. Motherfucker, I'm black fucking soldiers. Super quick to steal one culture, trying to make it your own. Caveman, go home. Over 10 long nose, funny looking ass Donald. Got his nerve disrespecting President Obama. If you don't want us around, then let us leave. Pay the money you've been owing my people since they were set free. That 40 acres and a mule never came, but yet we're still outstanding. Outstanding in the rain, just waiting, pacing, and praying for God to step up. But now it ain't shit shaking. I was mistaken thinking scripture could have helped us. Following the faith of our very own oppressors. No justice, just us. Look at how the aftermath of slavery today still affects us. Our kids educated by the enemy, and they don't know shit about the history. They ain't teaching that in school. Leave it up to them coons. And all that's cool. Let the bygones be bygones. And besides, we've been killing off our own. Shut the fuck up, you know what? Uncle Tom, house niggas, slaves, see they motherfucking nuts cut. I pack steel in the hour of the chaos. If black lives still don't matter till you stay out.